Good morning again. The second case presented for argument this morning is Gillis v. Litcher. Ms. McGillivray.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Pamela McGillivray, counsel for Plaintiff Appellant Nathan Gillis, by appointment of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. The issue that Mr. Gillis presents to this court is whether a reasonable jury could find that defendants violated Mr. Gillis' Eighth Amendment and 14th Amendment rights by placing him on a punishment program that was run without authorization under the Department of Corrections rules or regulations and at the discretion of the unit manager in the prison that deprived Mr. Gillis of all of his clothes, coverings, mattress, blankets, of his regular meals, and all hygiene items, that in a program under which Mr. Gillis testified that he suffered from the intolerable cold, from which he suffered serious mental health injuries and also physical injuries.
I'm not clear exactly who ordered this thing. You said the unit manager?
Yes, Your Honor. The unit manager, Defendant Homp, had come up with this program on his own. Mr. Gillis was already a prisoner in the Supermax prison, which is the state's most secure prison. And Mr. Homp, after Mr. Gillis violated a minor rule infraction of sleeping with his head in the wrong direction.
But this was not sanctioned by anybody above the unit manager.
It was at the idea of Mr. Homp and at his design. It was then vetted through the deputy warden as well as the warden, who are both defendants in this matter.
Okay. You say he came up with this on his own. I thought he got this program from Colorado, that it was used there.
As far as its implementation in Wisconsin, and what I meant by that is it didn't come up through the Secretary's Office of the Department of Corrections or otherwise, but yes, he did learn of the program while he was on a visitation to the Colorado Department of Corrections.
Was there any documentation about the approval or by the higher-ups of this unit manager?
There is the initial memo that laid out this punishment program that was copied to the deputy warden and the warden, but then also in deposition, both the deputy warden and the warden testified that they were apprised of the ongoing punishment program for Mr. Gillis, because it was in particular for Mr. Gillis, and were made aware of the conditions throughout the time he was there. Because Mr. Gillis has presented...
Can I ask you, he was given a number of, and I'm not sure how many, verbal warnings before he finally got a conduct report on this, sleeping with his head on the wrong side. Was he told in any of these warnings that what consequences would flow from that?
He was warned, you are correct, Your Honor, that he was given warnings about sleeping with his head in the correct direction. He was never given a warning about what the extent of this punishment program was. It was entirely at the discretion of Mr. Homp and could last as long as Mr. Homp, and again with the approval of the warden and deputy warden, chose to continue the conditions. And so he had no prior warning that what the extent of these deprivations could be. It appears nowhere in the inmates get a handbook when they're brought into the prison. It appears nowhere there, and it's nowhere in the DOC regulations.
But when he's given a number of verbal warnings and told that he has to conform to that rule, which the department says is necessary for security reasons, why doesn't he comply, and especially after he gets a written conduct report?
Well, he was actually already, before he got the written conduct report, which included a 15-day cell confinement time for the same conduct, Mr. Homp added on this additional punishment. So there was no opportunity for the deterrent effect of the loss of out-of-cell time and other privileges that went along with the conduct report to have worked its way to see if that was sufficient for Mr. Gillis to learn that he cannot continue to violate this minor rule infraction.
Ms. McGillivray, you have argued this basically as a condition of confinement case. But isn't this really a case involving whether the assessment of this punishment violated the Eighth Amendment? shouldn't we be looking at this in terms of under that analysis, that this is a punishment case?
Your Honor, we've presented this as given the totality of the conditions, the reasonableness of the punishment for which there is no penological purpose, the fact of the conditions that he's naked with, which is not in relation to the minor rule infraction that he did did disobey, the fact that he had ongoing physical and deteriorating mental health. So,
you know, if you on page 22 of your brief, you touch on what could be called a punishment kind of analysis, but on the whole, I mean, this is straight conditions of confinement.
That is how we have argued it under the conditions of confinement, under the Farmer analysis, that this was this violates the evolving standards of decency.
Should we undertake some sort of inquiry into the into proportionality? I mean, as to whether or not this this action by the prison authorities is compatible with the nature of the offense?
I believe, although we did put this under the rubric of a conditions of confinement claim, in looking at this at the duration of the conditions and the severity, and then we have also included, because there is no reasonable penological purpose for the extent of these deprivations given the rule that was violated, that taken all together, that the conditions meet the objective standard under Farmer.
Well, let's assuming we should look at it that way. In other words, weave in, I suppose, the reasonableness through the reasonableness idea, a proportionality inquiry. It does seem like an awful lot of punishment for not sleeping in a particular position in a bed. But isn't it fair to say that this that your client also simply made this particular issue an issue where of drawing the line in the sand with respect to the authority of the prison authorities? It was he tested them. And he had, and he's in the maximum. He earned the right to get into that prison. So don't we have to look at all of that as well?
We didn't contest the reasonableness of the rule itself, and he could not have undone by taking any certain action the punishment program as it was implemented entirely under the discretion of Mr. Homp. So even as the district court found that even though he may have opened himself up to some punishment, opening himself up to this type of punishment, it does not give the Department of Corrections, in particular unit manager and also the deputy and deputy warden, the authority to come up with whatever punishment they want to whatever extent without looking at the nature of the violation.
See, here you're starting to slip into away from the conditions of confinement into the magnitude of the punishment for the offense, whether the punishment fits the crime, aren't you?
We do not believe that that he had the opportunity, or that it is a fair analogy to say that he could have, for example, had the key to this type of punishment, because it was completely at the discretion of the unit manager, and he did not have prior knowledge of, if I do this, this is what will result. What we're saying is the conditions under this punishment violate the objectiveness of the Eighth Amendment, so that
there's no requirement, is there, that the prisoner know the exact punishment for an infraction of the rule before he commits the infraction?
No, but in this case, the unit manager and the other defendants came up with a punishment that meets the objective. That meets the objective test triggering his Eighth Amendment rights, so put him into conditions. He did not need to have notice of exactly what how he may be punished, but he cannot anticipate through his behavior that he will be put into conditions that violate the Eighth Amendment.
Would there be any circumstances in which this punishment would have been appropriate, in your view?
given the length of the time and his injuries, physical and mental health, and given the severe deprivations and the nakedness, I believe that those conditions violate the Eighth Amendment.
So your view is this is simply beyond the pale, period.
Again, given all of the conditions in which he was suffering and his mental health deterioration.
Refresh my recollection, please. How long did this go on for?
This went on for 12 days.
During that period of time, was he examined by any health care individual?
He was seen by a health care individual, but the punishment took precedent. The record shows this both in her deposition testimony and in the other defendants, that the punishment program took precedence over the mental health care, so that although he did see a mental health person, he did not receive mental health care. Rather, the conditions continued for punishment.
Thank you.
And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
I want to ask you before you sit down, though. This is the supermax prison where the conditions are tougher than they are in any other prison in the state. And if he's put in this behavioral modification program, and if after an hour, hypothetically, he is given the option of conforming his conduct to the requirements of this rule or staying, and then he make the decision that he doesn't want to conform to the rule, would that be unconstitutional in your view?
Under this particular program, there was no opportunity for him to get out of it.
I'm saying hypothetically. Let's say the program was tweaked a little bit, and it was that's how it would operate.
For the duration then being 1 hour for which he was...
No, 1 hour, and then you get an option of whether you're going to be removed from the program or you're going to stay in it. I think there's two phases of this program, and the first phase is more restrictive than the second. So during that first phase, what if there was a requirement that the prisoner be given an opportunity to conform his conduct to the rule?
That situation is not what we have on hand.
I understand
that. If he were had not suffered any mental health or physical injuries by that point within 1 hour and then refused to do whatever exact task he was supposed to do to get out of there, that may not rise to a constitutional level.
So in your position then is the minute he goes in, there's a constitutional violation here.
In this particular case, once he went in, he could not get out no matter what for at least 10 days, but then that amount of time could be extended for whatever period. And it wasn't a specific conduct that could have him removed from the punishment program, but it was anything that Mr. Hump, the defendant, thought was inappropriate behavior could extend it. So whether it's, in fact, what did extend his time on the most extreme deprivations was throwing feces and splattering blood on his cell.
That increased by a couple of days.
And not the conduct that had originally put him into the punishment program in the first place. And if I could just the district court made an issue of the 5 days versus the seven. However, the record does show that there is very little distinction between the second stage, where he did get a poncho-like garment. That was the only piece of clothing. He did not get bedding or a mattress after that time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Dressel Velasquez?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Adrian Dressel Velasquez, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, and I'm representing the defendants' appellees in this matter. We're here today because Gillis, an inmate plaintiff, deliberately and repeatedly violated a valid prison rule, just as was the case in Freeman v. Berge and Rodriguez v. Briley. The rule in this case required inmates at WSPF to sleep with their heads towards the back of the cell and to do so in an unobstructed manner. The reason this rule is in effect, if you look at the pictures attached to the affidavit of Ricky Govier, which is on docket number 244, you can see a view from the cell hallways into the cell. And it's just the design of the prison is that if inmates are sleeping with their heads towards the hallway, towards that window, the guards can't see anything except basically their knees and below. So the rule is in effect for the inmate's safety. It's to make sure that the guards can ensure that the inmates are breathing, that they're alive. The reasonableness of this rule is not in dispute. Mr. Gillis repeatedly violated this rule basically as soon as he was transferred to WSPF.
But wouldn't it be better to have some way to get out of this behavioral modification plan program early on if you inmate indicated a willingness to conform?
And that is something I would like to bring up, Your Honor. Counsel for Mr. Gillis has claimed that he was never given a warning as to the consequences of the punishment, and that's just not true. He was given verbal warnings. He was given counseling. He was then given the conduct report. After all, none of this counseling and discipline worked, it was then that Mr. Hunt decided to implement the BMP. But there's a difference between implementing the BMP and activating the BMP. Mr. Gillis was put on the BMP, so he was told, this is what's going to happen the next time you violate the rule. It wasn't an immediate taking away his clothes, taking away his property. He was warned of the consequences. Mr. Hump went to his cell, gave him a copy of the BMP memo. Mr. Hump explained to him what the BMP was, that the next time you sleep the wrong way or the next time you put the blanket over your head, the next time you obstruct officers' view of yourself while you're sleeping, the BMP may be activated. In fact, even after the BMP was implemented, so Mr. Gillis was told you're on this plan, within an hour, Unit Manager Hump once again saw Gillis sleeping the wrong way. Mr. Hump didn't immediately activate the BMP at that point. He again gave him one last warning, and in effect, he told him, next time you violate this rule, I am going to activate the BMP. It was then, again, within the next hour after giving him that last warning, Mr. Gillis was seen not only sleeping the wrong way, but covering his entire body with the blanket. It was at that point that Mr. Hump activated the BMP. And it was at that point that, yes, all his clothing was removed. It was just Mr. Gillis with no property in a bare cell. There are also just a couple things I would like to bring back into the attention of the court, in that, yes, this BMP did consist of two stages. So although Mr. Gillis did end up being on it for 12 total days, the BMP was designed to last only 10 days, with the first stage lasting only 3 days. And it was that first stage where he had absolutely no property and was fed Nutriloaf. The last 7 days, stage two, he was given a SegSmock, which is a relatively thick, as she said, poncho-like garment that goes to just above the knees. He was given regular meals at that point. He had hygiene items. He was allowed to take showers at regular shower times. What happened in this case was that Mr. Gillis, after the BMP was activated, he began to basically bite on his cuticles to get blood. He then used that blood. He would continually push at his fingers to get blood. He would use that blood to wipe on the walls as well as to wipe on the cell window. He also smeared his feces on the cell window. He didn't begin to clean that up until, I believe it was the second day of his first day of the stage one, and that's why those first 2 days were repeated, because he was obstructing officers' view of himself by smearing
feces on the
window.
Is there any written directive in the prison as to the circumstances under which this program can be elongated? Did the unit head have to report that to the warden or the deputy warden? Was there any kind of limitation on this whatsoever?
Well, there was a limitation as to both, obviously, Unit Manager Homp's discretion as well as the warden's discretion. There wasn't anything written to that effect. And, yes, the way
the warden even notified that it was extended.
Yes.
I see.
The other thing that I would like to rebut is that counsel for Mr. Gillis has stated that the punishment in this case took precedence over his mental health care, and that also is just not the case. As soon as Mr. Gillis did start acting on these these inappropriate self-harm type behaviors of smearing feces and biting himself, he was placed on clinical observation. And in fact, clinical observation took precedence over the BMP.
And what exactly is clinical observation?
Clinical observation is a status that inmates can be placed under if they are harmed to themselves or to other inmates. If you look at Exhibit 108 attached to Bradley Homp's affidavit, you'll see the clinical observation logs, which shows that every 15 minutes when an inmate is placed under clinical observation, staff needs to check on them, make sure that they're still alive, basically, at that point. Usually clinical observation is used when inmates are on suicide watch.
And those notes, are they reviewed by any healthcare professional?
The notes can be reviewed by healthcare professionals. In this
sure
case,
sure they can, but should they? Are they in the regular course?
In the regular
business?
Basis, I believe they are, yes.
Does the record confirm that?
The record does confirm that crisis intervention workers, that the psychiatrist, that the psychologist, Dr. Apple, all reviewed and evaluated Mr. Gillis throughout his stay on the BMP, which coincidentally took up 10 of the 12 days that Mr. Gillis was under the BMP.
Now, everybody in the supermax is in segregation.
That's correct.
So when he is in this program, he's in the same cell he's always been in.
In this case, he was moved from different cells. When he first began smearing his feces and his blood, he was moved from one cell into another cell.
During that first 2 days?
Yes.
Okay.
During the first day.
But ordinarily, then, the program, when it's put into place, he is in the same cell that he's been in, except everything is taken out of the cell.
Correct.
That's right. Now, he got this program from Colorado. Has there been any litigation in Colorado about this?
There hasn't, and that also goes towards, in the end, qualified immunity. Mr. Gillis, or Mr. Homp, I apologize, had gone to Colorado as sort of an exchange between the DOCs in Wisconsin and Colorado. He had seen the BMP implemented there, and that's where he got the idea and brought it back to WSPF. And in fact, the reason that this BMP was implemented in this case was because after Mr. Gillis was repeatedly violating this rule and it didn't appear that normal counseling and discipline were working to change his behavior, they have weekly unit staff meetings, and this is where the BMP was brought up. And basically everyone agreed that this BMP would better demonstrate to inmates that they're responsible for their conduct. They're going to understand the consequences between cause and effect for their behavior, and it is putting them in control of their behavior. It is giving them the keys to their own fate. Mr. Gillis wouldn't have faced any of these consequences if he had just simply slept the right way in his bed. He was totally in control of his behavior, and he was totally in control of his fate.
Anything in the record about the efficacy of this program? I mean, have other inmates been put in it? Is the word around that this is something you don't want to experience?
I know that other inmates have been put on the BMP. I can't tell you as to how well it worked in the other inmates' case. I can tell you that it did work with Mr. Gillis. After this occurred, there wasn't a repeat of his sleeping the wrong way. As far as the Eighth Amendment claim, the objective portion, the defendants continue to maintain that his conditions of confinement were not sufficiently serious as to be a denial of the minimal civilized measure of life necessities. He was always fed. He was always sheltered in a cell that was above 70 degrees, and there is documentation of that. He was always kept safe, and that's demonstrated not only by the times he was seen by nursing staff, by healthing staff, by psychological staff, but also by the fact that he actually was put in clinical observation. As to the defendant's deliberate indifference to his health or safety, again, there's no evidence in the record showing that any of the defendants were deliberately indifferent to his health or safety. Instead, the evidence shows that they were mindful of his health and safety. Again, this is shown by placing him in clinical observation. This is shown by the repeated times that nursing staff, that psychological staff, visited Mr. Gillis. And it's also shown by the fact that all of the defendants were in agreement that his placement under the BMP would demonstrate to him the cause and effect, that it would show to Mr. Gillis that if you misbehave, these are what the consequences are going to be. On March 5th, which was 4 days into the BMP, Mr. Gillis was evaluated by a psychiatrist, Dr. Meyer, who noted that he didn't appear to be depressed. He did not appear to be suffering. Either Dr. Apple or Dr. Meyer at any point could have superseded the BMP because he was under clinical observation. They could have said he needs to be taken off the BMP, he needs to be given more property. None of them did that because none of them felt that he was in any danger. As to Mr. Gillis' 14th Amendment claims, again, it's a pretty similar analysis. Mr. Gillis was, as you've already pointed out, Your Honor, at WSPF, so he was already in segregation. He's already in the most serious, secure prison in Wisconsin at the time. He was a level one inmate because he had just recently been transferred there, so his property rights and his privileges at that point were already diminished. It's also important to note at the time...
Do you stay in level one at the Supermax before you progress up to level five?
I'm not certain, Your Honor. I believe that they're given an evaluation after
is
the first...
Is it based on behavior, or is it just after a certain amount of time you...
Well, clearly, it is based also on behavior. If you're not doing the appropriate behavior, then they'll just keep you at level one. But as long as you're doing what they ask you, then you move up to levels. As far as the 14th Amendment claim, it's also important to remember that this was back in 2002, before Wilkinson. So when we do get to, if we need to get to a qualified immunity analysis, that is also important to remember because at the time, at least in this district, there was at least cases pointing to the comparison group at that point should be the most restrictive prison in the United States, if not the most restrictive prison in Wisconsin. So saying that his placement on the BMP was a significant and atypical hardship in comparison to the most restrictive program in the United States just does not meet that muster.
As to the Eighth Amendment, if we could return for a second, what's your strongest case that you would suggest, case law, that would suggest a comparable situation which was not found to be unusual?
Your Honor, I believe the strongest case, which isn't precedential, but is out of the Second Circuit, and that's Trammell versus Keene. And in that case, an inmate, it wasn't called a BMP in New York, but that was out of New York. In that case, an inmate was put on what was called a deprivation order, where he was withheld, let me find it, just one second. He was withheld, he was deprived of a mattress and bedding for 14 days, clothing and toiletries for 17 days, and an inadequate supply of toilet paper for approximately 1 week. The court in the Second Circuit found that he had no Eighth Amendment claim because the defendants were not deliberately indifferent to his health or safety, in part because the inmate held the keys to his own cell door, figuratively speaking, and could have rid himself of the harshest aspects of the order by simply reforming his behavior. There are also cases out of the Eighth Circuit.
That addresses or comes close to the temperature conditions when combined with the clothing. I mean, doesn't this set a kind of a new high or low watermark on temperature / clothing or lack thereof?
It does, Your Honor. My time is up.
If I ask you the question, believe me, you have permission to answer it.
Thank you, Your Honor. The cases out of this circuit where inmates have been allowed to proceed on temperature claims have all been with inmates where the temperature is not definitively known. In Murphy, you have an inmate who's claiming that he had no clothes or heat in the middle of November. In Lewis, the plaintiffs were allowed to proceed because they alleged that the temperatures fell between 52 and 54 degrees. In this case, it's undisputed. The temperature was always above 70 degrees. The other cases, such as Dixon and other cases, the inmates were alleging cold that was, if not freezing, close to it, where they could see their breath, where it was freezing outside and there was no heat inside. That's just not the case in this particular incident. Thank you very much for your time.
McGilvray.
Your Honor, I think that what Mr. Dressel-Velasquez pointed out is that there are many issues in dispute for this matter that should go back to the jury. He mentioned temperature. What the record actually demonstrates is that there were cells that were measured, not Mr. Gillis's cells, that were above 70 degrees. The only temperature, the only evidence of the temperature of Mr. Gillis's cell is that from the testimony from Mr. Gillis himself, in which he testified that he was intolerably cold the entire time he was in the confinement. Mr. Dressel-Velasquez mentioned the Tremel case and other cases in which there were temperature recordings above 70 degrees. Again, no temperature recordings for Mr. Gillis's case. But in those cases, there was not also the mental health deterioration that was at issue in this case and the physical injuries that were alleged by Mr. Gillis. As far as Freeman, we discussed this before, but he did not have a way of undoing the punishment or knowing what that punishment was going to be ahead of time. It was not a simple, if you stand a certain way, you will get fed. There was no cause and effect lined up like it was in the Freeman case, or Rodriguez, for that matter, with the putting your property in the box before you can go get your food. This was at the discretion of Mr. Homp to extend for as long as he wanted, for whatever purpose Mr. Homp found was important. Mr. Dressel-Velasquez mentioned my time is up.
You can conclude your thought.
Thank you. The clinical observation, the district court found that the conditions did not change at all upon him being placed on clinical observation. The record supports a finding that he received no mental health. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. Ms. McGilvray, I want to extend on behalf of the court an additional thanks to you and your colleagues for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Gillis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.